Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
On with me, I have a guest, Jane Ginn, who is a fellow board member with me on the Cyber Resilience Institute Board of Directors. Jane, welcome today.
Well, thank you very much, Chris.
So Jane is big into threat intelligence and cyber threat intelligence. We're going to have her talk about that and try to keep it out of the very technical roots detail, but you know a little bit about what that is. But first of all, Jane, tell us about your story, your background, how you got to where you are, and what your passion in life are.
So I started in the Washington, D.C. area in engineering consulting, in environmental engineering. This was back before the days of the internet. And as the internet emerged, I was one of the early adopters and decided very early on that I needed to sort of retool. So I did that and transitioned from environmental engineering into the IT sector. And since that time, I've worked primarily in global organizations that were dealing with global IT issues. And then I started to teach. I taught for about a decade in a couple of different programs in a business college and then also in an information sciences and technology, all for the University of Phoenix. About 5 years ago, I started to become very alarmed with what I was seeing with respect to the security of the systems I was teaching about. And so I decided to go back and get another master's degree. I went to Norwich University, and it's back in Vermont. I went to their online program, very, very rigorous program in cybersecurity. And since then, I've been focusing primarily on cyber threat intelligence, which is a fairly narrow area of the cybersecurity field.
Mm-hmm. Cyber threat intelligence. So are you originally from Vermont? Is that what you said?
No. I just chose that program because it was one of the best in the nation.
Uh-huh. Are they focused on cyber threat intelligence there?
It's actually the oldest private military academy in the United States. They have many different programs, criminal justice and information technology, cybersecurity, and many other programs as well.
But yeah, a lot
they
of
they are designated as a center of academic excellence for their cybersecurity program.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with all the programs out there, and Norwich was one I had not really heard too much about. But then I know cyber threat intelligence is a lot of offshoots from the government. Is there more of a government focus there, you think?
There were a lot of veterans in the program or active duty servicemen. Mm-hmm. And so there were people that were focusing on FISMA, which is the federal information sharing standards that all the federal agencies have to adhere to. I was focusing on private sector issues. Mainly, mm-hmm. Most of my research was on the banking and financial services.
Okay. All right. So you're a member of the board of Cyber Resilience Institute. We've talked about that when we've had quite a few of the founders and guests on that were from the CRI. What is your take on what Cyber Resilience Institute is doing in the cyber area?
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack.
Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
So, I really envision the CRI as a think tank that executes programs that focus on public-private partnerships. One of the programs that I've been very involved in is standing up an information sharing and analysis organization, or an ISO, for the sports community. We're building out this sports ISO for both amateur and professional sports to identify threats to athletes and teams, sponsors of sports games, and to venues. So there are three different broad categories of victims or potential victims that threat actors may target. And our threat intelligence initiative is aimed at identifying who those threat actors might be and then alerting either law enforcement or the target or the victim themselves so that they can take offensive action.
So threat actors, basically we're talking people on the other side of a keyboard, on a computer somewhere, going after some virtual asset. Is that a good definition?
If we use the term threat actor, that typically indicates people, but we also sometimes use a more generic term called threat agent, which could be a group of people. It could be a gang, a hacktivist gang. It could be a group of people that are politically motivated. It could be a government-sponsored group of actors. And typically in the threat intel world, when we see patterns and we're able to link different attributes together that demonstrate how a particular group may work, that is, they may be using the same infrastructure or the same type of malware, then we call those either campaigns, or if it persists through time and it's highly targeted, we call them advanced persistent threats, or APTs.
So we have talked to a couple other people about threat intelligence. And just my take is the cat and mouse game of person group versus person group at an organization trying to either do their own will, mischievous or whatever, or do a government's will somewhere else, or defend on the other side. And that's kind of what's going on with threat intelligence in general.
I think the way to think about the threat intel space is that for so long within the cybersecurity industry here in the United States, we've had to be on the defensive mode, where we've dealt with configuration management and patch management and strong passwords and multi-factor user authentication, et cetera. And those are all defensive, which is very, very important as part of an overall program. But if we're going to be able to defeat this very aggressive enemy or these very aggressive sets of enemies that we find ourselves up against, then we need to be smarter about how we're doing it. So we need to be more proactive. And that's what threat intelligence is all about, is being more proactive, going out and hunting for indicators of compromise on our networks and on our endpoints, and then using those indicators of compromise to share with one another so that we can then all get smarter about how we're defending ourselves against the
So we're making a good guys team, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're sharing all the information we find out about what's going on. But isn't this kind of an endless stream of all over the world, there's going to be more and more people becoming computer savvy. It's an endless stream of bad guys.
It is. It is that. And that's why it's so important that we begin to automate as much as possible the threat intel sharing piece. And that's where certain protocols or standards that are being developed come into play. There's an international standards body called OASIS, the Organization for the Advancement of Structured Information Systems, mm-hmm. that now is developing a suite of protocols that will guide how this sharing takes place, what the common understanding is, how the terms are used, like we talked about threat actor just a moment ago. Mm-hmm. So how we define things like threat actor. So once we get those definitions down and we have these protocols working, then we're able to automate our sharing much more effectively.
So a protocol, a computer language, basically if somebody finds a threat, everybody gets it immediately, is what I'm hearing, that what the sticks and taxi are, the information model and the actual protocol byte model over the wire, those two, I forget which one's which. But what'd you say, the Cybox, what is that level? And explain kind of a little bit of the, you know, what they are and the differences and, you know, how somebody might need to, what they might need to know to just start to understand what they're looking at.
Okay, so you named the three different protocols in our suite. We have STICS, which stands for Structured Threat Information Exchange. We have TAXI, which is the Trusted Automated Exchange for Indicator Information. And we have Cybox, which is Cyber Observables. So think of it in a nested manner. STICS is the overall data model that we use that many different communities of interest may be able to use. Law enforcement, network engineers, forensic scientists, malware analysts. The STICS data model is aimed at establishing a common language that all of these different users can use. Cybox is nested within STICS. Cybox has a whole series of very, very well-defined, very granular objects that characterize both state and stateless properties on a computer. So, for example, we have a network object. So how this object operates on a network could be a Cybox object. But then we also have, at the STICS level, we have an incident. So if one sees some malicious activity happening within an organization, they can establish an incident and then use the Cybox language to characterize what's actually happening on their network.
Okay.
So that's how those two work together.
Okay.
And TAXI is the Trusted Automated Exchange. So that refers to how the information is being shared between organizations. So one thing we haven't talked about in today's session is the trust circle model that has arisen here in the United States and is also operative in the United States and in Europe and other NATO countries. And that is where we set up information sharing and analysis centers, or ISACs, mm-hmm. and information sharing and analysis organizations. And those are all aimed at establishing trust between and among specific organizations that share these threat indicators.
And these are industry specific. So there's a ISAO or ISAC for each industry, and everybody in the industry kind of voluntarily gets on. And if you just get on and start, you get everybody else's objects and things that threats that they identify. So right away, the value of getting on, if you're not part of the industry ISAC, is to start getting everybody else's threats.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities, designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
So ISACs are industry specific.
Okay.
ISAOs can be established for a geographic area, for a topical area, those kinds of things.
Do they cross? And how do they cross?
Sometimes companies are members of both. So if, say, I'm a bank and I'm a member of the what they call the financial services sector, ISAC or FSISAC, then I might also have many branches in the state of Maryland. So I might also join ISAL that's organized around the state of Maryland.
Okay.
And that way there is some correlation and cross-fertilization between the ISACs and the ISALs.
Okay. So if you had never heard about ISAC, ISAL, threat intelligence sharing, and you have an organization, the first thing to do is get in touch with a local ISAL, ISAC. What's the first steps that somebody would do?
The first thing I would do is join my local InfraGuard unit. InfraGuard is a public-private partnership that's run by the FBI. There's at least one InfraGuard chapter in every state, and in some of the more populous states, there's multiple InfraGuard chapters that just cover a particular metropolitan area or a particular region. And those are fantastic networking opportunities because you're working with other people within the law enforcement and critical infrastructure, key resource areas, so where everyone is working together to try to protect their networks and make their systems more resilient.
Okay. And so that's step one, and then you get in touch through them with a local ISAL and then maybe an industry ISAC and start getting online with it.
And
they'll have the requirements for you need this system, this is how you plug in, things like that.
Many of the ISACs and ISALs are now mounting vendor-based products that we call them threat intelligence platforms. There are probably 12 or so vendors in the country, in the world right now, that are developing these threat intelligence platforms. And they do different things depending on who their user base is.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole objective of the threat intelligence platform is to integrate various feeds that come in many different formats, normalize those formats so that the data can then be used by analysts, either threat intel analysts or malware analysts or risk management professionals to make decisions about how to manage networks, how to resource various units within an organization, and then finally, whether or not it makes sense to share any indicators of compromise with a trust community.
So now they're almost like an outsourced threat intelligence company that you would hire to do some of this work for you. Say you're a small, medium company, you don't have the infrastructure to have somebody spend all their time on threat intelligence. You'd hire one of these third-party companies and basically do some of that for you?
Well, what I was talking about really was a vendor product. There are, however, some companies that have taken on as their business model what we call a managed security services provider or an MSSP. And those managed security services providers then typically have a threat intel platform as one of the many products that they use. And then they provide that service.
Okay. So what kind of companies, list a couple of those that you're aware of? Okay. So these are very hush hush. I guess some cloak and dagger stuff going on here.
Well, I'm subject to mutual non-disclosure agreements about certain companies.
So these aren't public things we're talking about then?
They are. It's just that by contract I can't.
Okay. I understand. We won't pressure anything there. So, but going back to the cloak and dagger thing here. So we're talking a lot of companies, governments. I heard a lot of three letter government agency acronyms in there. What does the average person that has an iPhone and goes about their life and drives down the road and works at a non-cybersecurity threat intelligence company or doesn't work at a three-letter acronym agency like NSA or FBI, where does this impact them?
So when we get down to the personal level, what we're really looking at is protecting our personally identifiable information in our banking arrangements and in our healthcare. And so we all now, whenever we go to the doctor or the eye doctor or have any lab work done, we have to sign that HIPAA release. Mm-hmm. And the HIPAA is a law that was passed that governs how medical information is shared. And so we are all subject to the potential for loss of information from records in medical institutions. Mm-hmm. We also are subject to the loss of personal information through our banking activities. Because the banking industry is so heavily regulated, they have, more than any other sector, improved their cybersecurity, and we're beginning to see fewer and fewer hacks and fewer data breaches in that industry. But while we're seeing that go down, we're seeing a tremendous amount of personally identifiable information, or PII, being scraped from medical institutions. Mm-hmm. And what happens with that PII is that it's then sold on the black market in what we call the dark net, and on a per record basis. And then threat actors purchase that and then try to use those identities to make purchases or travel or buy houses or buy cars. Basically, they steal the identity of another individual. Mm-hmm. It's not the only thing that can happen. Blackmail can happen. Espionage can happen. So there are many different uses.
Yeah. But from I'm not hearing a consumer market use, though, here. Is that the case?
Well, from your endpoint, there are a number of different apps on our phones, mm-hmm. that we can download that can improve our cybersecurity. So there are some consumer market products at that level. On our computers, there are certainly antivirus solutions. And
So they're connecting to threat intelligence now, the antivirus. And I know there's, if you have a WordPress website, you can get some plugins that do threat intelligence, see where you're getting hits from, kind of pull that together and cross-reference it to some of the Intel platforms.
Exactly.
So I guess that's a consumer place that you might be hooking into it. But I wasn't aware that there was some iPhone apps or some Android apps that do this with your phone.
I was really referring more to malware protection
okay.
for the phones.
Okay.
And what happens with the malware analysts is that the indicators are coming in so fast, many hundreds every day, mm-hmm. Into the various malware companies. And so as they get indicators of compromise and as more information about how specific pieces of malware operate, that's shared back to the malware community, the broader malware community. And so then the various malware vendors update, they push updates constantly to our malware products. And that's, it's all intertwined with the threat intel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if now I'm a young person and I say, this sounds interesting, how would I get involved? How would I learn some, you know, where to start? I think you do some of those trainings all the time, right, Jane?
Yes, yes. I think it's really important to learn the fundamentals. If you're in college, high school or college, learn about basic computer science, learn some programming languages, learn operating systems, particularly focus on the Linux operating system. Once you learn those and you learn how to work at the command line on computers, then you can start getting into some of the higher level analytics that we're talking about with threat intelligence. And there are courses that you can take online. There are free courses online. There are seminars that are offered by the various vendors. So there is a way, I think, you know, in a pretty cost-effective manner to come up to speed on some of these issues. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you do some of those trainings or will this summer. Is that something open to the public or something that people could contact you and get signed up for?
I have done public talks in a number of different venues, but all of the trainings that I have scheduled currently are for private entities.
Okay, all right. So right now, I guess we'll look at, go to your university, see what kind of things you can have, scheduled, lined up. I think even through some of the ISAL stuff here locally, there's some young kids getting involved with it. So starting in the high school age, which is very impressive. So, if you're not on board, you're going to be missing out here in the future, right?
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure.
Okay. So anyway, Jane, great talking to you. This has been a definitely informative talk. Is there anything you would like to give a shout out to, your company, anything that you do or have going on in the future that you'd like people to get involved with you on?
Well, I think we talked about it a little bit, the sports ISAO and the whole notion of protecting amateur and professional sports. I see this as a very important opportunity for us as a society to take an initiative or a practice that we have to, and then to extend it to recognize the risks that we live in the modern world. So we can use the enthusiasm we all have around sports to segue into this sort of new wrinkle in our society. And I'm actually very enthusiastic about the idea of protecting sports as a way of life, as a symbol of freedom. And I know that many of the threat actors that are against us, particularly more the political activists, are very much opposed to the freedoms that we hold. And so the mm-hmm. sports ISAO, I think, represents a way for us to counter that kind of thinking.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on today, Jane. And we appreciate everything you brought to our show here. Have a great day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.